Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Founders Club Radio.
Welcome to the Founders Club, where each week we talk to the founders and leaders of great private companies. I'm your host, John Coffin, and this morning I'm joined in the studio by Cannon Bailey, the president of Racemark International, and Fred Castellucci, the president of Castellucci Hospitality Group. Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
Cannon, I'll start with you. Tell us a little bit about Racemark International and what you guys do.
So Racemark International, we're the leading supplier of automotive floor mats to car companies like BMW, Mercedes-Benz, and other premium manufacturers. We were started by both my parents in the early 60s, and my father, he started the company as a first as a racing parts mail order business while he was a racing driver with Porsche.
And so this, you guys are 51 years old now,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
Started in 1964?
Yeah.
Congratulations. That's incredible.
He started the business really, he didn't even go to college. I mean, started it right out of high school, kind of during his racing career. So an entrepreneur from the beginning.
Okay.
And he started developing, really focused on racing parts during that part of his career. He had a mentor during the time, Mark Donahue, who was also a famous racing driver from the era. They both drove in what was the Trans Am series, which was a pretty exciting period in car racing. And now
Trans Am period. Tell me a little bit about that.
So that's a period.
Is that the distance driving or?
Yeah, it's endurance racing.
Okay.
So like the 24 hours of Daytona, 12 mm-hmm. hours of Sebring, that period. So, yeah. And, a lot of the really exciting, you know, that was kind of when Porsche, Ferrari, all these brands were brand new in America. And, that's really kind of where they built their reputations, for people today.
Okay. Great.
They kind of transitioned from being focused on racing parts and, you know, not every car really needs a roll bar in it or, you know, not everybody needs a fireproof racing suit. But they said every car really needs an automotive floor mat. And that was kind of a new accessory they were developing. So they had these relationships with the car manufacturers and, you know, started really at the beginning. We were BMW's oldest supplier in North America.
Okay.
And, same with Mercedes-Benz. So, really, as they built their companies in the 70s in America, we grew with them, and we started all that and sort of grew to where we are today.
And now, how did you decide to get involved after college, I guess?
So it really wasn't always a plan in my mind growing up or in college. My parents encouraged me to work at other places and sort of come to that choice on my own, but I think it was a tremendous opportunity. I knew I wanted to take advantage of, and an opportunity to work, with car companies. I've always been a big car person growing up in this family. So, I love being able to go in and work with the automotive designers and talk about the new models they're developing and mm-hmm. How we can build something unique that's a part of it.
So, I mean, you mentioned BMW and Mercedes, but today you really work with almost every luxury brand there is, as well as some of the U.S. auto manufacturers as well. So, really
yep.
incredible diverse group of companies that you're working with.
Yeah, that's definitely a challenge. Is each brand sort of operates a little bit differently, even though they're all car companies, they're all building cars. Recently we started working with Tesla, for example, and they're a really extreme example of a car manufacturer. They really look at things totally differently. So that makes it really fun and exciting. And there's different cultural challenges between a German customer versus a Japanese customer, an American company. So that makes it really interesting and exciting.
Is a lot of your dialogue on a global basis really at the headquarters of all the different companies? You're probably on the plane quite a bit.
Yeah. I'm flying all the time, but each company is a little different, but yeah, a lot of the Germans are very centralized back in Germany, and some of the other Asian companies are a little more decentralized, so you work more on the U.S. level, but
you now have manufacturing facilities in Calhoun and yeah. also in Hungary and Switzerland, so talk about that expansion. I guess you really started the company up in New York, and then you've kind of come down here and expanded globally. How did all that happen?
So, yeah, we started in upstate New York, and in the early 90s, our customers, which were mainly the German brands, they started building factories down in the southeast. You know, BMW up in South Carolina was one of the first, Mercedes in Tuscaloosa. And so our business started to change in the 90s, where we stopped sort of shipping to ports, but then started shipping to the factories. So we always had kind of bought all of our carpet from the south, from North Georgia. So it became a natural transition that we started this factory down here. And in 2009, when the economy changed, we and our business had changed a lot by then, we decided to move our headquarters and all of our operations down here. So,
has that been ultimately a good decision to be closer to the product, so to speak, and I guess to some of your key manufacturers as well?
Yeah, it's definitely been a great decision, a really difficult decision at the time, because you know, we had over 100 employees, and a lot of them had worked for us for 20-something years. And really, as a family business, you know, all of your employees are like part of your family. So, yeah, it was an emotional, difficult period for us. But at the end, you know, our business is stronger than it's ever been. And we found, you know, the workforce to be tremendous down here in Georgia. And we find people from the automotive and the carpet industry. And in Georgia in general, it's been a great place to do business. Really happy. We wouldn't even have predicted, I mean, how many more manufacturers are building plants here, like Volkswagen and in Chattanooga, and you know, Mercedes now moving down here and relocating here.
Right. And how did the Hungary and Switzerland operations come about? Have they been part of the company for a long time, or
yeah,
is that more recent?
My parents really saw from in the 80s that as our business grew, that we had to have more relationships back with our customers in Europe. So we started the factory in Switzerland back in the 80s. And about 2 years ago, as our business really grew a lot more in Europe, I helped start a plant in Eastern Europe for high volume manufacturing. And so now that gives us a really strategic competitiveness in Europe that's been really exciting to see.
So is there a just-in-time element of your process and your support of all of these different folks?
Yeah, absolutely. The automotive industry is definitely very global, and so all of our customers look at us and say, you know, we need to be able to buy the exact same product in North America, Europe, eventually Mexico, China, you know, are very strategic markets for them, and they need all local supply chain just-in-time. They want you within, you know, maximum, you know, 1 or 2 hours their plant, and you know, to the same global specifications. You know, they build a 3 series in, you know, in different continents around the world, and all of them, they want to be the exact same kind of car. So
that's the next frontier, I guess, for you, is perhaps Mexico or someplace in the Far East.
Yeah, definitely. Mexico and China are really the growing future markets for our industry.
The other thing that's kind of interesting is I think there's an element of cyclicality to your business, not the way oftentimes other business owners think about it, in that, you know, sales around the holiday season or quarter to quarter, but it's really for the different models that come out. Can you talk about that a little bit and how you kind of manage that cyclicality?
Definitely. So I think it's an advantage to our business that you know, we supply based on a vehicle platform, and those can last for 5 to 8 years. So we have really long sales cycle in our business, where it could take 2 years to win a contract, and then you supply that for 8 years. So you're almost talking like a 10-year contract cycle for our business. But so you can have there's advantages because you can do some long-term planning, but it can lead to big peaks and valleys if you don't time it correctly. So having a diverse customer base is really important to us. That's how we try to manage that.
Great. Okay. And, you know, you mentioned some of the trends that you're seeing from the global manufacturers, but are there other global supply chain trends or issues that you're, you know, kind of can look at in the future and see?
Yeah. So at the same time, you know, our customers demand just in time. They also, you know, it's a global competitiveness. So your supply chains are sometimes longer, you know, but they have to operate just in time for global competitiveness. So we recently invested in a, you know, real state-of-the-art logistics system. So all of our customer orders are integrated into our system, and they can change those almost daily on a on a rolling basis. And so you really need to have the you know, world-class logistics systems to be able to support that and feed that to your suppliers.
Gotcha. So is being here in Georgia helpful from a port standpoint, or is your delivery so much more on time than that it's hard to kind of manage around time on the water?
Yeah, it's both, you know, so our big, you know, product carpet, that's the main component that goes into our product. That's all we try to source locally. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we can't supply our product if, you know, a tiny, you know, feature is missing that we may import from China or Europe. So it doesn't matter if we have 99% of the product on hand. If we don't have that 1%, we can't ship it. So it's a combination of international logistics and local just-in-time supply.
It's kind of mind-boggling to even think about. It's really, really remarkable what you guys have been able to manage and your interaction with so many different car companies. What's a recent win that you're particularly proud of?
I would say
you probably. I know you love all your customers, but
yeah. I would say Tesla is probably one of the most interesting companies. About 3 years ago, when our head of sales said he wanted to go out and visit Tesla, we were a little nervous, you know, because these were new companies and no one's ever been successful starting up a whole new car brand. And a couple of other people tried, you know, Fisker is an exciting electric car company that,
right,
you know, was really at the same position as Tesla 3 years ago. And
DeLorean back in the day.
DeLorean is another example. So, yeah, it's definitely completely unheard of really in the last 100 years to think that someone was going to pull that off. And now they're really, everyone is looking at them, even the big manufacturers, and what they're doing. And I think they've got all the right elements that are going to make them successful in the future. So it's really exciting that I give a lot of credit to our head of sales that he had that kind of foresight and he saw it back then. So.
Right. That's really remarkable to be there from the beginning and kind of see it expand. Yeah. Fred, I'm going to switch to you. Tell us a little bit about your restaurant group and everything that you guys have going on these days.
Yeah, of course. You know, we basically have four restaurants here in Atlanta. We have our newly opened Cooks and Soldiers that opened just about 6 months ago. We have Double Zero, as well as Iberian Pig and Sugo. And just to kind of give you a little overview of the company and kind of where we came from, you know, I grew up in a restaurant family. My father and mother were always in the restaurant business as far as I could remember, and grew up in an entrepreneurial family as well. And you know, the highs and lows that come along with that. You know, I was able to, you know, learn a lot from a young age about, you know, how to run a restaurant and how my parents had run a restaurant in the past. And, but also saw the, you know, the successes and failures. You know, I went through a, you know, period of time actually on a couple of different occasions where, you know, the family was riding high and then all of a sudden, you know, we have to figure out what our next move is and, mm-hmm. and, moving out of the big house and doing all that stuff. So it's a very, you know, it's and those kind of experiences growing up have definitely informed the way that, you know, I run the business and that I look at business decisions. And so, you know, I went to Cornell Hospitality School and kind of got a little bit of a hospitality education, but was never really sure that that's exactly what I wanted to do, getting out of school. But I found myself in a unique scenario where my family's businesses at the time, Sugo, we had a couple locations and I had worked with my dad to do some franchising and we had a restaurant that had just actually failed and gone out of business with a franchisee. And so I had the opportunity to, you know, take over a turnkey location mm-hmm. For next to nothing and kind of make it my own and grow it and build it, which was a blessing and a curse, you know, taking over.
Trial by fire a little bit.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, I was, you know, 21 and had my own business and, you know, but a business that had failed with the same name and in a difficult location in Johns Creek. So it was an interesting experience to say the least. And, you know, it taught me a lot about the fundamentals of the business and, you know, what it takes to to make a successful experience, and so, and also what it takes to run a successful financial business. And so I came in and I, you know, dramatically cut costs, mostly staffing costs, to bring the business to some level of break even. We were still losing money. And, you know, within 8 months, I was able to kind of rebuild the reputation to a certain extent. And, you know, eventually was able to turn a profit. And within 2 years, I was able to save up enough money to open Iberian Pig on a shoestring budget back in 2009.
Okay.
Which was, again, an interesting experience. Definitely a bit naive in thinking I could, you know, take $80,000 and open a restaurant with it. But nonetheless, I found a location that on the Decatur Square that had recently closed. And so there was, you know, less upfront cost than you'd typically associate with a full build out. Mm-hmm. So I was able to leverage that little bit of money and some barter contractors. And I became the general contractor myself and managed the job and was able to get the restaurant open and back in 2009. And since then, you know, day one, we opened on a Friday night, which you're never supposed to do. But I had over leveraged myself and had no money left and literally couldn't pay for the inventory that was in the restaurant. So I had to
had open. To open on Friday.
Yeah, had okay. to open on Friday. So first night, it was great. House was packed and we never looked back. It was like Monday came around and there was money in the account and we just kept rolling from there. And the business grew tremendously over, you know, a pretty short period of time. And a lot of the lessons that I learned when I really struggled in the early days about the customer experience, about, you know, delivering hospitality, really informed the culture that I had built at this restaurant where it was from scratch. You know, I created the concept myself. And so that really was a big part of how I looked at growing the business, was really that when you only have a few customers, you know, you really focus on every single one of them. And if you take that same philosophy and you kind of move it towards a larger business, but still with that focus on each individual customer, I think that's really where our success has come from. And then 2012, I opened Double Zero here in Sandy Springs. And that was, you know, a great concept as well. Southern Italian, Neapolitan pizza, fresh handmade pasta. We also do, you know, entrees and, you know, antipasti and small plates and things mm-hmm. like that, and a full pastry bakery program. So it's quite an undertaking. And that's been open. Actually, it was open in 2011. So we're, you know, a little over 4 years in, which is crazy. And then 6 months ago, we opened Cooks and Soldiers, which was based on a trip that I had taken through the Basque Country of Spain and France. And I was really inspired by what I saw there. It was really a research trip and a wine trip to kind of get some ideas for Iberian Pig potentially. But
that's a nice perk of your business, is you can have a wine trip somewhere.
Yeah, that, exactly.
Canon and I would probably be up for the next one of those.
Yeah, no, Canon's probably going to get the invite. but it's, you know, it was an inspiring time. You know, I was able to take a little bit of time off and reflect on the business and where we were and where we'd been. And seeing what was going on in San Sebastian and even in parts of, you know, Basque French region and mm-hmm. the, you know, even in the interior part near the Pyrenees, and seeing the vast breadth of the cuisine, but also how focused it was on that particular region. You know, mm-hmm. you didn't see a lot of like international cuisines. It was, everything was really Basque cuisine. There's like the Pincho bars, there's the cider houses, there's the Asador's, the wood fire grill restaurant, there's the Michelin star restaurants. And so there's really this kind of pecking order almost of the cuisine there. And it was very interesting to see. And so we were really inspired by it. And I came home and basically like, all right, this is what we're doing next. So that was, I guess, a little over 2 years ago. And Cooks and Soldiers has now been open for 6 months. And, you know, in our second month in business, it was already our highest grossing business. And
fantastic.
Hasn't stopped since. So
congratulations. This is just incredible to hear about the progression. Talk a little bit about the benefits of scale, you know, going from running one to, and the challenges of scale too.
Of course.
You know, there's probably pros and cons to having four restaurants that are mm-hmm. very different, but also at the same time have elements of supply need, I would imagine.
Of course.
Consistent.
Well, you know, I had an interesting discussion. You know, the restaurant business in Atlanta is it's a pretty small community, so we all tend to know each other and see each other in the restaurants and talk. And you know, I was having the same actual discussion with Steve Simon, one of the owners of Fifth Group, who owns and runs a much larger company than we do. And we talked about this very same issue, how challenging it is. You know, when you run multiple units with multiple concepts that all need to be maintained and evolved over time, and really take that guiding hand of somebody that in a leadership and also from a creative position are making sure that these businesses stay relevant mm-hmm. in a very fickle environment is very challenging. And then comes the corporate overhead side of it. So it's, you know, as you go from one to two, you can really manage it yourself, which is what I did. You running back and forth and constantly putting out fires and doing all those things. Then you realize when you go from two to three, everything changes. You really need to start thinking more about the cost that it takes to run those businesses successfully. So you maybe bring on a little bit of corporate overhead to handle that. And then when you go from three to four, you realize that there's a lot of things that really need to get taken care of. And so you build that even more. And so with every successive restaurant in the beginning, it really, it's challenging because once you hit a certain number, you can manage it really well with a certain amount of corporate overhead. Mm-hmm. But then there's that tipping point where you really have to commit to growth. And so for us, that tipping point really is somewhere between now and the next restaurant. So, Okay. You know, between four and five, you really need a certain level of corporate overhead to make that work. And you really need to commit to going to seven or eight in order to have that, you know, that financial person, that director of operations, that marketing person. You know, I have a assistant as well. And so all of those things kind of deteriorate your margins ultimately. And right. So you have to be really careful with that and making sure that you're running the businesses as lean as you possibly can. And then, you know, of course, there is some benefits to that scale, but those benefits tend to be a little bit less from a cost perspective because we're not all buying the same ingredients. Every right. chef is managing their own business, and so we look at it more from a marketing perspective. When people, you know, see one place that's part of the group and they have an amazing experience, they want to try the others, and so there is the kind of the rising tide essentially that happens there, which is a big part about creating a group that has different brands like that, mm-hmm. as opposed to having a chain where everything is the same and you just duplicate it.
Right. So, you know, it strikes me that hospitality or your business is a team sport. And, you know, so much of it is about motivating and training the people that you have. Talk about how you do that and get them to peak performance. And, you know, it's a repetition business. I mean, it's the every night is really important, and that's there's a no level doubt. Of urgency that perhaps doesn't exist in other businesses. Talk about that a little bit.
That's what makes it so fun, honestly. I have a good friend of mine who's a filmmaker, and we talk about this. It's, you know, when he makes a movie, you know, it's in the can, it's done. Anything that is going to happen in the future has no effect on that movie that's already been completed. And, you know, and for me, it's more like a show. It's like a Broadway show. It's mm-hmm. like every night is a new performance, mm-hmm. and it's a new performance and an ability to improve on the previous night's performance. And I think that's really the way that we approach it. There's this thing that I talk to a lot of the managers about is, you know, maintaining a short-term focus and a long-term focus simultaneously. And that's the biggest challenge. So, you know, on the short term, we have to make sure that we're properly staffed and that we have the food in-house and that things are, you know, getting executed properly and people are in the right positions and everybody's ready to come into work and not everybody is completely hungover and, you know, all of those things that, you know, happen in the restaurant business. But then there's the long-term focus, you know, are we maintaining our culture? You know, are we maintaining, you know, that level of hospitality and the, you know, the sincerity and the kindness of the employees, not just to the customers, but to their coworkers and creating an environment where, you know, great hospitality can happen. And so my goal is really to preserve that culture as much as we possibly can, to make sure that the hiring decisions we're making at the top level trickle down to the bottom level, and those people that we're hiring, making good hiring decisions to bring on people that can deliver great hospitality. And then once you have that DNA of great people to begin with, and you're constantly monitoring that, then it's really just about putting constructs in place to make sure that they're supported. The issues of motivation largely go away when you have people that are hospitality oriented to begin with. And then it's really just about supporting good people.
So there's almost kind of a DNA strip that's either in someone or not. And
there's no doubt. Yeah. I mean, either you're hardwired to be a kind, hospitable person, or you're not. And, you know, we all know the people that are not.
How do you find that through the... What's your typical interview process for your managers? Do you have a set system, or is it a little bit more?
It's a little bit of both. So there's a set system. You know, they have to, specifically for servers, I think. But we do this with everybody in the organization, you know, whether you're a dishwasher or a cook or a chef. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they have a working interview shift where they actually come in and we see them work in the restaurant. So, you know, somebody can have the greatest personality in the world, but you know, if they're too slow to handle, you know, a significantly busy night, then it's not going to work. You know, right. They have to be able to move. It's still a very physical job, so there's that aspect of it. So we do the working interview if they pass the first interview, and sometimes even a second interview for a server candidate, which, you know, you'd think is a little excessive, you know, maybe for a server, but these are people that have the most impact on the dining experience.
Yeah, that's your point of the spear, right? You know, you've got to make sure
they're spending more time with a customer than any other person in the building, and including myself. So those people really are critical to the operation.
You talked about innovation happening on a trip, it's always fascinating to me how innovation happens, and I'd love to bring both of you into this. Have you had other kind of interesting experiences where you just kind of have these aha moments, and talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, at least for me, I know that those things typically happen to me when I've had some time to reflect, you know, and get away from the business. You know, when you're in the day to day, it's hard to see those big things. You know, I mean, you can encourage your, you know, chefs and people on the, you know, on the front lines to do cool things and research, and, you know, we have these like brainstorming sessions for menus and things like that, which we come up with great ideas, but the big ideas and the, you know, the trends and what I see happening in the industry as a whole typically happen either when I'm traveling or, you know, able to reflect and you know, sit back and think.
Cannon, yours is a little bit more of a repetitive process, but you know, it's changed so dramatically, and it probably has different requirements for different of your customers. But you know, how do you guys innovate and manage that?
I think for us, like you say, it's a, you know, we're in a pretty rigid business where our customers typically will give us, you know, this is what the next vehicle will look like, and here's your specs, and you know, they may even have drawings, and you know, there's not a lot of wiggle room. But once we build a relationship with our customers and they trust when we're supplying them to, you know, every day, and, you know, in BMW's case for years, you know, we get the opportunity to work in front of their designers, work in front of their engineers, and, you know, show them new ideas, new concepts, and hope that they work their way into the next program. So, you know, it's probably the part of my job I enjoy most. I really wanted to be a car designer when I was a little kid. That was like my dream job.
Uh-huh.
And today it's maybe 1% of my job, but it's one of the most important parts, is to spend time with our customers and understand what they want, and maybe show things that they don't know they want yet. And then bring that back to our team and help them develop and launch those ideas. And do that, you know, that's a really fun part about manufacturing, is it's super hands-on, it's tactile, and that makes it fun.
Yeah. Both of you are, you know, in second-generation businesses. Talk a little bit about that transition time, and if you could give any advice to other 2G folks who are either taking over the reins or about to.
Yeah, it's funny. Ken and I actually... have this discussion somewhat frequently, sent me an interesting article about family firms and how successful they are, despite predictions by economists years ago that, you know, family firms would go away and get replaced by professionally run MBA students. And that just hasn't happened. And
right.
I think that there's a lot to be said for, you know, having that kind of continuity. And Cannon's business has been around a lot longer than ours has. And although, you know, my family has been in restaurants since the early 1900s, I mean, my great-great-grandfather was in the restaurant business. And mm-hmm.
Excuse me, so you're a fifth generation.
Yeah, but you know, it's a lot harder to create longevity, you know. Right. I mean, because, you know, our businesses right now are technically first generation, mm-hmm. you know. You know, our oldest business right now is 9 years old,
right.
you know, so 10 years old. So it just, it's a different thing altogether to create longevity in the restaurant business. And a lot of times you have to see it as it's a business cycle, you know. I mean, if you're lucky to get 20 to 25 years out of a restaurant before, you have to think about your next step. And so there are very few that can break that mm-hmm. that cycle. So for me, you know, it was really about learning from what I'd seen in the past and seen, you know, from my father and mother and what they had done really well and what was successful for them. And, but also what didn't work. And, it was interesting, you know, in the very beginning, I tried to model my style just after them and what I had seen them do that worked. And I just did that, you mm-hmm. know? And so, but then as time grew and I started to see, okay, well, you know, I can do this and I can do this and it still seems to be pretty successful. So maybe I can try this. And so you just keep, you know, changing your style over time to what really suits you and your personality and the type of leader that you want to be.
So there's kind of a great starting point and that kind of experience of observation. Mm-hmm. But then there's also the evolution that happens from that point.
Exactly.
Yeah. Cannon, thoughts on the transition? I know you've been involved in the business now for quite a while in different capacities and, you know, are taking a much bigger role now.
Yeah, about 9 years. And, you know, I would say, you know, part of growing up in a family business is, you know, it's hard not to inherit that passion. You know, if you've got passionate, you know, parents that started your business, you know, my passionate about cars, passionate about, you know, running your own business and growing it and creating that. So that's something that's definitely in your DNA if you grow up with that. Now, you know, when it's working well, it can be one of the best things in the world when you can combine family and business, because you know, you have the opportunity to continue a legacy and build on something that your parents spent years building. So and you get to learn things about your parents. Like, I definitely, you know, if I by working with them and working in our business, I have tremendous respect for how they were able to build it. You know, mm-hmm. I had no idea how difficult it was and the risks you always have, you know, and so when it's working well, you know, it can be the best thing in the world. But I can also say it when it's not working well, it can be the worst thing when you both, you know, your business life is, you know, not working well, it also affects your family life. And
sure.
So it can go both ways. And it's never easy. So I don't think that changes with time. It's always going to have that challenge. But, you know, that's just the nature of it.
Right. You know, it's interesting, too, that it seems like so often, back to the innovation concept, technology is somehow linked to it. And, you know, the restaurant business has been around forever, but I'm sure there are elements of technology that help your business. Talk about that, and where you're finding advantage, so to speak, by investing. And Cannon, I'd love your perspective on it too.
Yeah, so it's very interesting. It's an area that a lot of startups are focusing on right now is restaurants, because it's such a tactile business, something they can see. You know, any kid who wants to go out there and start his own technology business has probably dined in a restaurant before. And so these are the businesses that oftentimes people focus on when they're trying to think of the next great big idea. And so I see a lot of technology come across my desk on a very frequent basis. And I'm also personally very involved in technology. I actually helped found a company, a technology company here in Atlanta called We & Co., which attempts to solve the hiring issue for hospitality businesses and, you know, acquisition of talent and managing that whole process, because we found it to be very challenging. And so I worked with these two guys to help create that. And that business is still around and doing well. And I also invest and advise in technology business as well, specifically in the hospitality arena. And so Atlanta is actually a growing city for, you know, this type of technology, B2B, and even in the hospitality kind of sector. And so
B2C, I guess, OpenTable or something like
that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And those companies are rare because they're actually both, you know, they're selling to businesses, but they also have a brand that, you know, consumers use. And so it's very interesting. You know, we were one of the first 10 restaurants in Atlanta on OpenTable. And, you know, we've always been early adopters of technology and implementing it into the business. And over the years, it's had a great effect on the way that we run our business. And it's not just OpenTable, but we use technology in almost every piece of the business, whether it's analytics on a real-time basis. I can see in every minute up to the date where our sales, where's our labor, you know, what guest checks are open. I'm looking at specific customers' checks, whether it's comps, voids, what employees are clocked in. I mean, can see all that information.
Do you know what I'm going to order the next time I go?
we don't
have some predictive.
Yeah, we don't have the predictive technology yet. But then, you know, likewise, we have tools that allow us, you know, on our mobile phones to see, you know, past sales as well and analyze that, and as well as, you know, 16 camera views in each restaurant on my cell phone. And so, you know, I use technology because for me, when you run multiple businesses, there are all these great tools that allow it to, you know, you to keep an eye on it a lot better than you used to. And it allows me to have a little bit more freedom with my lifestyle than a restaurateur would typically have in previous years. So
interesting.
I don't have to be in the business every moment. Right. I have to be there when it's most important.
Mm-hmm. Great. Canon, technology in your business?
Yeah. So even though we have a pretty low tech product, you know, we definitely look for ways like logistics systems, like I was talking about earlier. I'd say communication, you know, is a big impact on, you know, how we're able to run a global business. You know, I can have so many different ways to communicate, you know, video conferencing, and it's that I think is something that is different than when my parents, you know, were starting their business in Europe 30 years ago. But I'd also say that, you know, I think that you got to be very careful with technology, and I'm very careful in how we focus on innovation or technology, because it's really some of the most disruptive change to a business. And I think that a lot of businesses, and we've made mistakes in the past where we've maybe overemphasized technology, you know, to compensate for weaknesses in other parts of our business. And so I always am careful, you know, to understand, you know, how good is our quality, how good is our people, you know, that are going to be managing this technology. And if all of those things, which is really the foundation of your business, are not strong, to think that you can use technology to improve it is a little, I don't know, foolish. So that's always, I think, a very careful balance, that technology is one part of your business, and, you know, it can't compensate for weak areas of customer service and things like that. So,
oh, there's no doubt about that. I couldn't agree with you more, because we've made mistakes as well where we were too early an adopter of a piece of technology. And because of the flow of new technology that's getting created, you know, we really do have to be very careful about what we decide to invest in. And even if it's a zero cost product, implementing a product into any business, and I'm sure, you know, this is even greater in Canon's business with such a large business, so much flow, is extremely difficult. And getting the human piece of that to work well with the technology is the most challenging part. And I usually take a look at, you know, two factors when I'm evaluating new technology. I say, you know, is this going to make the manager's life easier? Is it going to be something that they're going to want to use because it improves their quality of life? Or is it such a significant cost or revenue cost savings or revenue generating piece of technology that we can't afford not to use it. And if it passed one of those two tests, usually we'll give it a shot.
Okay.
But otherwise, you have to be very, very careful. You can't go too crazy.
Right. I ask everyone that comes on the show what the best piece of business advice was that they've ever gotten.
I can start. You may not like this as much being a banker, but you know this is something I think goes hand in hand in business. Is one of my mentors. He really reminds me a lot. That people and product lead a business, not numbers.
Right.
And obviously you got to have that foundation. But when you're growing, I think you can try to create a crystal ball with financial projections and financial models. But if you don't have the right people and the right product that you're passionate about, then numbers are kind of meaningless. So.
It might be surprising, but I actually agree with you. That's how we run our business too.
Yeah.
Fred, best advice?
Yeah. It was probably maybe not a piece of advice, but actually just kind of watching my father in action growing up, and just the way he always taught me that how important the customer is, and how he would put the customer before himself, and never let his pride get in the way of making someone happy, I think that's something that when the owner or the, CEO of the company, has that feeling and they put, the customer or the staff before themselves, I think you tend to see powerful things happen. And
you kind of invert the, invert the organization
exactly.
In the right way, and great things happen. Both of you have kind of chosen to build your businesses in Georgia and the Atlanta area. Talk a little bit about the state of entrepreneurism as you see it in the city and in Georgia, and I guess Cannon, from your standpoint, kind of coming in here more recently. Would love your perspective on that.
Yeah, I'm really happy, that we chose to move to Atlanta and in North Georgia, and I think it's a tremendous city. For me, it's a global city, and that's one of the key elements that's kept me here, and chosen to build our headquarters here and grow it from here, because it's got both a great quality of life to live. A lot of diversity in what's happening, and it's great to be part of a growing economic region. And so the certainly the investment in the airport, that's been a long investment here, is tremendous asset that Atlanta has, and it's an investment that I think keep paying dividends of growth in the future. So that's definitely.
Yeah, I mean, I've lived in Atlanta for 15 years now. Outside of my family moved down here right after the Olympics, and then I went away to college and came back. It's been incredible to see the growth of the city in that short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And not just in our business, because, I think the food scene and the hospitality scene and the entrepreneurship of people going into business for themselves in food and beverage businesses has been tremendous. Even in just the last 5 to 7 years, I think that
it seems like it's accelerating,
exploded.
Yeah,
exploded, and that can really only happen when you have two things happening, where there is the demand for those types of experiences via a lot of the big corporate companies that create all these jobs that people of a certain affluence are able to go out and dine and go to cool places. And then the second piece, which is what we've always lacked, is the talent. Mm-hmm. In the industry in Atlanta. I mean, we've been an affluent growing city for a long time, but we lack that talent. And it's amazing to see now that these places that have trained a lot of the great, chefs, restaurateurs, service people in this industry are now starting to create their own businesses. And we see that, even in the short period of time that I've been doing it, people that have gone on to do their own things outside of our business that, are trained with us, which is exciting to see, those seeds planted around the city. And then, I think the next big piece for Atlanta moving forward is our technology growth. And we see that happening with, the big, not just like incubators, but pseudo incubators that you see where they're creating that critical mass of technology businesses and support for those companies. And that's really the next, I think, frontier for the city is to be able to, you know, we have a lot of great, you know, companies, whether it's logistics or, you know, retail or, you know, brick and mortar type businesses, but, you know, adding technology as a big sector to the city can only help.
Right. Yeah, it's very exciting what's going on. ATDC and Atlanta Tech Village and everything else that's happening within the organization, within the city, it's just remarkable. I want to shift to the speed round where I just ask you a couple quick questions. Fred, favorite movie?
Godfather.
Two. Okay. Two. Canon, any recent books or favorite business books that you really got a lot out of?
Yeah, I think Jim Collins' books, Good to Great, How the Mighty Fail. Those are two of my favorite business books.
You're reading my mind. I teach those books.
Yeah.
And recently, there's a book called Red Notice by a guy, Bill Browder, that I loved, all about doing business in Russia. You know, he was an investor there. That it was really exciting.
Interesting.
I'll have to pick that one up.
Thoughts on that, Fred? Sounds like you
incorporate
a lot of books into your thought process.
I teach Good to Great to all my managers. Mm-hmm. Like it's required reading.
Yeah.
So it's informed a lot of the way that I run the business.
Fantastic. So. Canon, you already touched on it, but Fred, what did you want to be when you were growing up?
I think it changed like every week. Like I wanted to be an NHL player. I wanted to be an NBA player. I wanted to be a shoe designer. I wanted to be a car designer. I wanted to be a fashion designer. It was every week was something new. So yeah. I was pretty schizo when I was a kid.
That's called being an entrepreneur, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Perfect training.
I have to take that trait down a few notches in the current business.
That's great. What about what are your passions outside of work?
Definitely cars. You know, I do a bit of car racing still with my father. That's something we do together that I love. And also got into running, cycling, triathlons is something that keeps me sane when I'm not working and does it in a healthy way.
What's a recent car race that you were involved in?
My father and I just did a rally around Arizona in one of his cars from the 60s. So that was really fun. A really beautiful place, and got to spend some time together.
Is this drive for 48 hours straight type thing, or is it a little bit more relaxed than that?
Definitely more relaxed now than what he used to do. So
yeah. Great. All right. Fred, what about you when you're not cranking it at all the different restaurants?
You know, definitely food and wine travel is a big part of it. You know, trying to keep myself sane, working out, yoga actually has been really great for me as well, to quiet my mind a little bit and be able to unplug. But you know, if I'm not working, I'm enjoying food and wine or working out. There's not a whole lot of downtime.
That's great. I want to thank you both for coming on today. This has been really fantastic. Canon, how can our listeners learn more about RaceMark?
They can go to our website, www.racemark.com.
Great. And Fred, we all are looking to go to one of your restaurants this weekend, if not more than one. Tell us how we can learn more about them.
Yeah, of course. Downtown Decatur, Iberian Pig, just walk onto the square and check us out, or 00 Sandy Springs, 285 and Roswell Road, right off the intersection. And Cooks and Soldiers is right at 14th and Howell Mill on the west side, right on that corner. And then Sugo and Johns Creek right off 141.
You've got them all over the city.
It's challenging.
That's great. Well, again, thanks. This has been fantastic. Join us again next week for another Founders Club broadcast sponsored by Atlantic Capital Bank and powered by Business Radio X.